Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
If I had not been abused, if I had not seen her reaction to when he peed in the bed, if she hadn't locked me in the closet, if she hadn't did that with the bathtub, maybe I would have believed someone kidnapped him. If I could make a deal and say, I don't want you prosecuted, I don't want this, just tell us. Just tell us and I would be happy. Tell us, give us a grave, give us something that we can go visit.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of The Vanished. Tonight I will be discussing the disappearances of two children, 22 years apart, one still lost and one found. These children happen to be connected by one woman, Susan Baker. She was a stepmother to one and babysitter to another. Susan Baker is currently serving a 25-year sentence for the kidnapping of 7-month-old Shannon Deirdrick. Shannon was found locked in a wooden box under a bed in Susan's home.
We are the proud papas of a little girl. This is Shannon Lee Deirdrick. We found her safe. We do not usually get the happy endings that we have happened to here today. If you want to see a bunch of grown men cry, tonight when we rushed her to the hospital and we was all calling home to our wives, let him know we'd found this baby safe.
Shannon was lucky enough to be found alive, but Paul is still missing. I spoke with Paul's sister Nina, and her story is truly heartbreaking, and for this reason, I broke this into two episodes. I had a few people listen to the interview, and everyone agreed that it was a lot to take in at once. Paul was just 3 years old when he disappeared. Both Paul and Nina had not had easy lives, and they both suffered horrific abuse at the hands of Susan Baker. Paul went missing from his home in South Carolina on March 5th, 1987. He had been home alone with Susan while Nina was at school and their father was at work. Susan's story is that she put Paul down for a nap at 11 a.m., and she fell asleep after drinking alcohol and taking some muscle relaxers. She woke up between 12:30 and 1:30 because the phone was ringing. It was her husband James, and he was calling to inform her that a woman had called his work and left a message saying that she had Paul and that he was fine. It was initially thought that Paul's biological mother had taken him, but this was eventually ruled out. I asked Nina to describe what it was like living in that home around the time that Paul went missing. She was just 6 years old when he disappeared.
Basically, it started when my mom and dad got separated. Because originally Susan was our babysitter. And as she was my babysitter, my dad was in the Marines. My mom was pretty much stay at home trying to go to school and work. And Susan and my father became romantically involved. Not saying my mom hadn't had a part in it. It was both sides that kind of was at fault. But initially when Susan was my babysitter, even at that time, she showed signs of aggression, I guess, or abuse. For example, there's one incident where she was still a babysitter. And Paul had done something, was crying really bad, and she told him to go to the corner. And he was crying because he didn't want to go to the corner. So instead of, you know, just walking a kid over to the corner, she shoved him. And when she shoved him, he had ended up hitting his front teeth to the point where it went up into his gum line. And that's where the scar on his chin came from. I was little. I saw what happened. But as far as being able to tell my mom or, you know, adult, how does a small kid really tell adult what really happened? So the initial story she told my mom was he fell, he tripped, he hit his chin, and everything got moved. So that was kind of like the first time that the aggression got, you know, there was something there. So after my mom and my dad separated, my dad went and with her and married her. We were with my mom and my stepdad. And the way we became in the custody of my dad and her was my dad pulled up at, we were at my mom's friend's house, and my dad pulled up in a black town car with his lawyer. And us being two kids, we were so happy to see her dad, we ran to him, not realizing what was about to happen. Next thing we know, we're going with my dad, and we're in the custody of my dad. So after, you know, we left there, we met Susan up somewhere, and initially she was nice, you know, hair bow, you know, kind of tried to doll us hair bows and getting us into ballet and, you know, you could imagine, you know, what you would expect a typical step-parent to do. And we went to court, and they did take me and Paul with them when they went to court, finally. And I remember me and Paul both crying, and my dad looked at me. He goes, if you want to go with your mom, go with your mom, but this is your only chance to go with your mom. Till this day, I regret that decision. But I was scared of, you know, if I went with my mom, because my, like I said, my mom was not a perfect mom. She had her faults. She made her mistakes, you know. So it was kind of like, I'm looking at two coins at that point, going, okay, I know what's with my mom, but I don't know what's with y'all. So I just stayed with, we ended up staying with my dad. So we lived off base, and he worked in the military, and we lived in a white house. And the white house was set up where you'd walk into the living room from the front door. There was a little dining room section right off of the back of the living room. To your left, there was the kitchen, which went into a little back, like, laundry area that had the back door to it. Between the kitchen and the living room, there was a hallway. You go down the hallway. His room was the first room on the left. Mine was the second room on the left. The bathroom was at the end of the hallway, and their room was on the right. Initially, you know, it was mainly me who got the whippings, I who got the aggression from her. Before, one time we went to my grandparents' house, my father's parents' house, and it was around Thanksgiving or so, because it was around my birthday. We celebrated my birthday, we celebrated my brother's birthday, but it was still kind of warm, so it wasn't quite like November. It was sometime before November. And I remember on the way up there, we went to, it was me, her, and Paul, and we went to the bathroom, and somehow it was her and him, and somehow his hand got slammed in the door and really hurt his hand. I mean, he had to get it bandaged the whole entire time we were gone, while we were at my grandparents', because it was that severe. And we had fun there. We were with my grandparents, you know, it was like, okay, nothing was going to happen to us at that moment. And I remember with all that going on, and I've talked to my grandparents since then, because I've gotten kind of their hindsight of it. They said neither one of us wanted to leave. We wanted to stay. And my grandmother, you know, after years have said she should have known something was wrong. She couldn't figure it out, but she knew something was wrong. But she didn't know what it was, and she couldn't just say, okay, let the kids stay with us. So we went back, obviously, home, And remember, I was only 5 or 6, so my timeline of when these incidents occurred, I don't know when exactly they occurred. I just know it occurred while we were with them. And, you know, I'm telling my part of the abuse so you might have a better idea of how capable she would be to do something. The first incident I remember is I was trying to learn how to count 1 to 10. Couldn't do it. By the time I got to 8 or 9, I would start crying, mainly because I was scared of what was going to happen. So the night before, my dad sat me at the kitchen table trying to help me learn how to count, you know, to 10, still couldn't do it. The next morning, after my dad went to work, she had filled the bathtub up with water and took me to the bathroom and said, okay, start counting, with me kneeling on the floor in front of the bathtub. So I started counting, couldn't do it. She dunked my head into the water, held it, pulled it back up. She did this several times. And by the time it was done with, the water was blood tinged. And afterwards, she told me, okay, now get in there and shower and clean up. So I did. Meanwhile, I'm sitting here going, I don't have no shampoo. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but meanwhile, while I was in that water, I sat there and go, I have no shampoo. But it was like the most logical thing that I would think of. You know, that was a normal thought. It was a normal thought at that moment. So I don't know what she had told my father about why, you know, obviously I had something cut on my face or whatever. I don't know. But I remember after that, I don't know how I learned how to count. Really, truly, I don't remember. I remember going to school, and I thought the teachers there were absolutely wonderful. But I would often be pulled, like, into, like, the counselor or whatever's office, and they would spend a lot of one-on-one time with me. But once again, you know, at that age, I didn't know what was really right or what's wrong, because, like I said, my mom wasn't perfect. At that point, I really hadn't had a really good, clear idea of what discipline and what abuse really is. And so after that, you know, there was another incident where I did something. I can't tell you what I did, but I ended up sitting in a chair in their bedroom in a corner all night with soap in my mouth. And I remember them sleeping in the bed. My dad says he doesn't remember that. I don't know if he was there. I can't recall that part, but I know that did occur. And, you know, that was like, okay, this is a typical punishment of standing in the corner. I was a kid. I mean, I know it sounds horrible, but I didn't know how to really understand what was really going on. And then there was another incident, probably closer to when Paul went missing, because it was summertime. And once again, I did something, I don't know what it did, where she locked me in their bedroom closet. For some reason, she enjoyed keeping me out of my room where all my toys was. Anytime she disciplined me, it was never in my room. And she had closed the closet door, and she had thrown a trash can in there with me to use if I had to go to the bathroom. And I did use it, so I can't tell you how long I was there. And once again, my dad was at work. So all of this was going on. You know, she didn't use switches. She actually used a stick. It wasn't like a tree branch, but it was a stick she used to use for discipline on us. So during this time, Paul was around. I know what occurred with me. I didn't see her really take out a whole lot of anger on him or with him until he started really urinating and peeing in the bed. And that's when she would use the kind of rage she had with me, with him. And it was getting worse with him. I remember us watching TV in the mornings. I remember watching TV with my dad. It's like, as long as he was there, we were safe. There was an incident where he and she had gotten into a huge fight because he thought she was too rough with me and disciplined me one night, to the point where they got in such a huge fight that she ended up locking me and him up in my bedroom because my doorknob lock was on the outside, which is really strange now that I think about it. Now that I'm that's really strange now. Wait a minute. Oh, now that I'm older, I'm thinking about that. But he was in the room, and I remember him using his credit cards and stuff and getting the lock, you know, using his credit card to get the door open to get us out. And he remembers that. And he told me at that point he thought she was being too rough with us.
Nina shared what she can remember about that fateful day in 1987.
So what I know is, as you know, I've gotten older, I've really kind of been able to understand more, is he was sick a few days before he went missing. Not himself. At all. You know, like I said, she was getting rougher with him whenever he peed the bed. And he'd always pee the bed. I mean, he used to pee in the bed when we used to live at my mom. It was normal to me. He was a kid. But it was getting worse with her reaction to it. And I don't really remember seeing him the night before. The morning I got up for school, I did not see him. I went to school. I came home. I got off the bus. I was, you know, and I can say this part because at one time they did hypnotize me trying to figure out what happened. But when they did it, they just let me do it for that day. They didn't let me go back further than that morning. You know, when they, you know, remember me telling them I was scared on the bus, I was trembling, you know, I knew I just didn't want to go home. So that was through what, you know, they've done with me over the years. But me getting off the bus, I remember coming off the bus and she was standing right there at the fence because we had a fence around the backyard. I go, "Where's Paul?" You know, because it was, "Oh, Paul's always there. Where's Paul?" "Oh, he's out here swinging. Go to take a nap. I'm sending him in soon." Okay, of course I'm going to listen to her. I'm scared to death of her. So I go through the front door and straight to my room and lay down. I never heard Paul that day. I never saw Paul that day. Next thing I hear is her crying, and I get up and walk down the hall, and I go, "What's wrong?" And she goes, "I just got a phone call that Paul's missing." I said, and I looked at her funny. I was like, "Oh, you know, I was a kid. What?" And she goes, "Go look." So I go down and look, and of course he's not in his room. And that's when everything started, you know. The whole time she's sitting on the couch, not looking, not calling for him, not trying to figure out, you know, did he go outside? How does this person? Nothing, just sits on the couch as if she's just waiting for my dad to show up. And from there, my dad showed up. And I guess they started the investigation, and I have a large, large time block between the time my father showed up to the time that they say about a week later investigators came, or not, but a detective came because they convinced my father to turn me over to family services, finally. And I remember getting in the car, and I was scared to death, and the police officer took me to my room, and she says, "You can take anything you want out of this room." I took one doll, and I remember getting in the police officer's car, scared to death, but she goes, "We're going to have Sloppy Joe's." I didn't know what a Sloppy Joe was. So they got me finally to the foster home that evening because they were having dinner. And I was so scared because I didn't know what was going to happen or what was going on, to the point where I just sat on the bench because they had like a picnic type bench in the kitchen for all the kids to sit. And I just kind of sat there, and anytime anyone ever, they tried to talk to me. And I would sit there and bark at them with the doll. I mean, obviously I was screwed up, so I'm not. But I would sit there and bark at them with the doll because I was scared. I didn't know.
My heart broke for Nina when she was telling me about this. I cannot imagine how scary that must have been for her to go through all of that abuse, her brother going missing, and then being put into a foster home. Susan Baker did go to prison for abusing Nina. Susan only had to serve 80 days of the 10-year sentence that she received for the abuse, and we will touch upon that a bit later in the interview.
As time went on and I was in the foster home, obviously I came to a conclusion, you know, eventually I wouldn't see my brother. Took me a while to wrap my head around that. But while I was at the foster home, they were good to me. I was happy. I couldn't have asked for a better place to have been. They were really, it was like, I was happy. I mean, I didn't get hit. I didn't get beat. You know, they took care of me. If I got up early in the morning and snuck around the alarms, which I wasn't supposed to go to the living room to watch cartoons, they'd fuss at me, but they didn't hurt me. They really watched me. From the reports and stuff, when they got me out of my dad's house, I had sores on my back. Open sores, which I still have scars from to this day. I've got scars across my fingers. Not bad, because as I've gotten older, they've kind of faded, but I still got the scars on my fingers, but the ones on my back are still pretty prominent. They almost look like they're round, almost like a cigar burn or something. And they had found a fracture in one of my hands or wrists or something that was healing that had never been treated. I eventually went to live with my grandmother. My grandmother, a lot of times, would ask me, why didn't I run away? Why didn't we go with my mom? Why didn't I do something? But, you know, as time gone over, you know, as time gone. And as I've gotten older, I realize that. It took me a while. So I lived with my grandmother for a while. Not a lot of contact with my dad over the years. Lived with my grandmother, eventually went to live with my mom, who has never been quite... How did I say it? She's bipolar now. I don't know if she was previously of all this, but she can at times, she still does not manage with it very well. We don't talk about him a lot between me and her, because often, you know, it's her son. On the flip side, when we do talk to him, I'm like, well, I was there. So there's a lot of back and forth between us because it was her son, but I went through it. So we don't talk about it a whole lot because it's a lot. You know, between me not being able to go live with her for such a long time and being at my grandparents, and even growing up when I went to go live with my grandparents after all of this, I wouldn't see her that often. I didn't see my dad, and I saw my mom, you know, when she came around, which sometimes was every month. Sometimes it was two or three times a month. Sometimes it would go 2 or 3 months at a time. Due to that, my mom did have another son, right before Paul went missing, and my grandparents ended up helping raising him also. Because my mom just did not, after all that, was not able to really take care of us, let alone take care of herself almost.
Even though Nina was protected from Susan, Susan was still able to manipulate and control the situation. I had read an article about how she kept track of Nina's whereabouts and would send her items in the mail over the years. I was really intrigued by that information when I read it, and that's when I decided to reach out to Nina. I had no idea at the time how bad the situation had really been.
So, meanwhile, my dad stays married to Susan, and they live in Florida. And once in a while I lived with my grandmother and so on, Susan would send me gifts or a card because she used to do ceramics. So she would make ceramic stuff and send it to me. Or they would send me a card, but I couldn't really tell if it was my father or not. Or we'd get typed letters, not knowing if it was him or her or what. But it was almost like a shadow over me. You know, now that me and my dad has spoke, he's no longer with her, and we have talked about this a lot over the last 6 months. It was her control over me. It was her control over him, both of us, to keep us apart. Me and my father never really, really talked about what happened in that house over those few days until the last 6 months. So there's been a lot of revelation, you know, a lot of stuff that's like, oh, on both of our sides, oh, and now he is starting to really, him, as in with me, knows she has something to do with it. We both agree it was during the night or early morning. So her sending us stuff was her way of keeping us apart.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished.
Nina did not see her father again until she turned 18 and made a trip to Florida to visit him. He was still with Susan at the time, and Nina got the chance to face her abuser for the first time after all of those years. Susan's manipulation only continued at this point.
The first time I ever saw him, which I didn't know this at the time, my grandmother was like, "You're 18. Here's a ticket. We're sending you to go see your dad for a few days over the weekend. Figured you need to get in touch with him, talk to him," because we had just started talking on the phone again because I had just turned 18. I said, "Okay, great." You know, what I didn't know was my grandmother was actually having like detectives follow me the whole time down there. I didn't know that. Because one, she wanted to make sure I was safe. And two, I guess they were trying to see if they could, you know, find out anything. So the first day I get there, I check into a really bad hotel. And my grandmother, I called my grandma, told her where I was at. My dad had showed up that afternoon after I checked in to see me. And we kind of walked and we talked a little bit. And then he was like, "Okay, I'm going to come see you tomorrow morning sometime. I'll be here such as that." I said, "Okay." So later that afternoon, unknowing to me, because like I said, it was a bad hotel. One of the detectives or guys came knocking on the door and I kind of opened it, but I kept the chain on. And they were like, "We're moving down to a better hotel. We're some construction workers or something." They gave me some fool lie about it. And I'm like, no, you know, because obviously my grandmother told me not to go nowhere with anyone. So I was like, no. So I didn't know that at that time. So the next morning, my dad showed up extra early. We walked around, you know, we walked down the street. We talked. We didn't talk about Paul too much. We didn't talk about what happened those few days. We mainly talked about, you know, what occurred between him and my mom and, you know, how, you know, those kind of things of how it led up to him and Susan being together and, you know, how I've been doing as I was growing up. And at that time I had asked him, "Sometimes I wonder why you're still with Susan." And I says, "Grandma says," which is the one who raised me, "that it may be because you wonder if sometimes if Susan will one day tell you, or do you really love her?" And he told me it's part of both. So I left it at that. You know, later that evening, we went to meet up with Susan for the first time I've seen her since I was 5 or 6. She had a doctor's appointment. So we had went over there to the doctor's office, and first time I seen her was actually in the doctor's room in a like hospital or something. And it was just me and him, and I sat across from her, and I was scared. I was scared. I sat there. I didn't talk a whole lot. But like I said, I knew as long as my dad was there, I was going to be okay. I'm 18 years old. I'm still scared of that woman. And they're like, "We're going to such and such house this evening. We're going to go do a cookout, da, da, da." So, okay. So I went with them. And it was a single wide trailer. It was her, a family of hers. And I was never left alone with her by myself. I made sure of that. I spent a lot of time outside on the porch. And, spent a lot of time talking to my dad. And so later on, you know, they took me back over to the hotel. Meanwhile, like I said, I had detectives following me, which I didn't know. Sometime during that day, my grandmother somehow called me and said, "I found out how bad the hotel was. I want you to move to a better hotel." So at that point, you know, I had them help me switch hotels and go to a better hotel, my dad and her. And my dad was like, well, I'm going to get you up, come be at you tomorrow morning early. We're going to go do something and stuff before you leave out the next day. I said, okay. So I get up the next morning. He was supposed to have been there about 10. And I was ready. 10 o'clock came. He wasn't there. 11 o'clock came. He wasn't there. 12 o'clock came. He wasn't there. So I call my grandmother. She starts making phone calls, but she's saying she's calling my grandma and Grandpa Baker. But as I know now, she was actually calling the detectives trying to find out what was going on. So she called me and she goes, he's in jail. I said, what do you mean he's in jail? She's like, something about him and Susan or something. He's in jail. She goes, a couple of officers are going to actually come and pick you up and take you in over to the jail to see him because I've spoken to them, explained to them the situation. So they came to the hotel room and went over to the jailhouse to see him. And he was obviously in handcuffs and in a jumpsuit and all. And come to find out, the night before, after they dropped me off, they got home and they gotten into a huge argument over me being there. An argument over him talking to me. And I've found out more details as we've gotten, you know, talking lately. And as they was having the argument, she goes, I'm going to call the police. And he goes, fine, call the police. Thinking, you know, she wasn't really going to call the police. So she actually called 911. And while she was on the phone with 911, my dad said he was in the background playing around going, help me, help me, help me, help me, playing. You know, thinking, okay, this, you know, the fight can't be that serious. And so obviously, you know, they heard that they were coming. So at that point in time, they got into some argument. She had went to hit him or something. She pushed him. And when that happened, he finally said, left the house. He was actually walking down the driveway. He said, as he was walking down the driveway, cops pull up. And he didn't know what was going on. They pulled up, was like, hands on your head, on the ground. You say they did all that. Obviously, the detectives who'd been following me, you know, obviously knew, I guess, was there. I don't know. So they took him in because it was her saying he pushed her. So I got to see him. I got to tell him bye. I went back to the hotel that night. The next morning, they actually drove me to the airport and made sure I got through security just in case. Even though we didn't think she would, but obviously we didn't think he would end up in jail the first time I've seen him in years. After that, we kind of stopped talking a lot, but sometime like the next year, sometime soon after that, he got extradited to South Carolina because they were trying to open up charges. And eventually they decided there wasn't enough evidence and they didn't want to roll the dice of trying to get a, it wasn't misdemeanor, it was something child abuse. On her against Paul. So they decided they didn't want to charge that case. So they kind of let him go.
I looked for more information on this and found that James and Susan Baker were in fact extradited back to South Carolina in 2000. A grand jury refused to indict them on the charges of assault and battery of a high and aggravated nature. They did, however, indict Susan on a charge of unlawful neglect of a child. That charge was dismissed in 2003 because they had limited evidence and also, since they were married, they would not have to testify against each other. They also did not want her to get a light sentence for a misdemeanor charge and then not be able to charge her in the future due to double jeopardy laws. It was after this that Nina was once again able to see her father.
At that time, he went to my grandparents' house and I went down that for a day to see him. And at that time, I was trying to convince him to come home with me. You know, don't go back to work, come home. I was really trying to figure out how to keep him here. But it did not work, obviously. I was 18, 19. It didn't work. So he went back with her. And we didn't talk. We haven't talked. Then the baby Shannon happened. And I had to work the next morning. It was about 9:30 at night. My best friend, who knows the whole story, called me. She goes, turn your TV on. I said, what do you mean turn TV on? She goes, I think your stepmother's on the news again. I said, what? She goes, turn the TV on. So when I did, my initial thought was, they found Paul. She finally says something. That was my initial thought. And obviously, as I watched, I realized that wasn't the case. And that she is now involved with another kid missing. And what I found out, like I said, after me and my dad's been talking, was a few days before that, she had told my dad, things are going to get rough again. If you decide to leave me, I understand. And he's told me he thought she was talking about Paul. Also, we both thought that, you know, when all this first came up. The way they found the baby was because had asked both of them questions, and she was very nonchalant about the answers. And I guess they figured out she was connected with my brother's case. So I think that's why they looked a little bit further, because they'd already did one walk through her house, through their trailer once. And some of this is what I got from my dad, but some of it's also what I've been told through detectives or in, you know, the news, what I've put together myself. So as they were searching the trailer, she was there and my father was there. And she was very calm and collective. And she was actually trying to show the searchers, the detectives, her birds and her animals. And as if they're not going to find anything. Very, like, socially, this is my house, this is my animals, da-da-da-da. And they almost missed the baby because it was in the wooden box. With the holes in it so it could breathe, with baking powder in the box. And it was so pushed all the way up. It was in their spare bedroom. And it was pushed all the way up under the bed, up against the wall with all the stuff in front of it. So they had to really dig to find that box. And the baby was alive. My father says he had been working a lot and he had no clue the baby was there. He had no clue, is what he said. He'd never heard the baby cry, nothing. That's kind of when I think he was dumbfounded. Like, I think that's maybe when the first alarm came on. Like, oh crap, she could have really done something with Paul if she'd done this. Obviously, they went through the trials and stuff. I did a newspaper interview hoping maybe it would bring up something with Paul's case. Nothing's really came about it. The reason why they did not bring Paul's case up in this is because they did not want her to be able to get off because of them bringing Paul's information in to the case. This is why. She had gotten felony child abuse with me. She was served 9 years. She served a total of 3 months for that. Because some judge signed off for it to be reduced. Because they were being too harsh on her because of Paul being missing. So some judge signed off for her to get released early on me because they brought Paul's case into it. That's why with the Shannon Derrick case, they never brought Paul's name up in it. I know that's why. Because she would have used that again. And that's why they never brought it or mentioned that. That's why they focused on just that. They still, to this day, don't know what she was planning on doing with that baby. My father didn't know about the baby. And you're married to a man. What are you going to do? Several years prior to that, she had divorced him without him knowing. They had bought a house together without him knowing they had been divorced. Even now that they're in jail. So when they posted that they were divorced, like after the trial and everything, they were actually legally divorced before that. Without my father's, you know, my father just recently noticed that. Strange to me. I mean.
I did a little bit of digging into the abduction of baby Shannon. I too wonder what her intentions were. It eventually came out that Susan had written to the governor claiming that Shannon was being abused and that her parents were using drugs. Susan had talked Shannon's mother into giving her the baby, but the mother ended up reporting her missing 10 hours later. When she did that, she didn't mention Susan to the police. Now, this is really odd, right? What the heck was the plan here? They did not bring up Paul during the actual trial, but the prosecution did mention him in the sentencing phase and said that she deserved the maximum penalty due to her involvement in that, and also her lack of remorse for what she did to baby Shannon. The prosecutor said, "At no time did she indicate that she was sorry for the actions she had taken, and she was very self-righteous about she did what she had to do, and she was satisfied with that." It is estimated that Shannon spent 36 hours in the 2x3 wooden box. The prosecution asked the judge to give her 1 year for each hour that she was in the box. The judge said, "This is one of the most bizarre set of events that I have ever encountered. No reasonable person would agree that this justified you taking matters into your own hands. I must admit, as of today, I still do not know what you intended to do with that child. If you have any information about the disappearance of Paul Baker, please call 202-433-9183. That brings us to the end of part one of this story. In part two, Nina will be discussing the impact that all of this has had on her life and also her family. Since Susan has gone to prison, she and her father have been able to reconnect and compare stories, which is what Susan had worked so hard to prevent for all of those years. They have come to some really interesting conclusions. Look for that episode to be available on Tuesday. First of all, I would like to thank Nina for taking the time to speak with me and for sharing this heartbreaking story. I know it wasn't an easy one to tell. I would like to thank everyone for listening and also those of you who have reached out to Diana from last week's show. The outpouring of support has been amazing. If you would like to contact me, I am on Twitter at TheVanishedPod. I have a Facebook page and a closed group. If you have any trouble finding the group, send me a message and I will get a link out to you. The closed group gives us a place to chat without all of your friends and family seeing your comments. There are a lot of great people in that group brainstorming ideas. If you have a missing loved one and would like to have them featured on the show, please email me at thevanishedpodcast@gmail.com. I also have a call-in line. You can call me at any time and leave a message. That is 814-826-4749. If you like the show, there are several things that you can do to help me keep on improving. First, subscribe on iTunes or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Give The Vanished a positive review and share the show with your friends. Also, I would love to know a little bit more about you, so please complete a quick survey at wondery.com/survey. I promise you it takes less than 3 minutes of your time. Again, that is wondery.com/survey. If you would like to contribute to the show to help me defray some of the production expenses, please visit patreon.com/thevanishedpodcast. There is also a PayPal button on the website. I would like to thank the listeners who have already done that. I truly appreciate it. I received some donations last week, and I am currently building a sound booth in my house. As I am recording this, the walls are going up. So thanks to all of you who have donated. I think that sums up everything I needed to say, so look for the next episode on Tuesday.
I've raised my kids to be very aware. I've raised my kids to question. If someone tells you to do something, you need to ask why. If they can't tell you a reasonable reason why, then you need to come tell me. I've raised my kids to be more aware of things like that. To be more aware of their friends. I've made them, like, you know, if someone, like, my kids were like, such as me at school. I'm like, well, how do you know something at home's not happening to him?
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.